of despair. My dad at the baccarat table, in the air-conditioned midnight. There's always more to things, a hidden level. Luck in its darker moods and manifestations. Consulting the stars, waiting to make the big bets when Mercury was in retrograde, reaching for a knowledge just beyond the known. Black, his lucky color. 9, his lucky number. Hit me again, pal. There's a pattern, and we're a part of it. Yet if you scratched very deep at that idea of pattern, which apparently he had never taken the trouble to do, you hit an emptiness so dark that it destroyed, categorically, anything you'd ever looked at or thought of as light. Chapter 12. The Rendezvous Point. 1. The days leading to Christmas were a blur, since thanks to illness and what amounted to solitary confinement, I soon lost track of time. I stayed in the room. The Do Not Disturb sign stayed on the door, and television, instead of providing even a false hum of normalcy, only racketed up the vermiform confusion and displacement. No logic, no structure. What was on next, you didn't know, could be anything. Sesame Street in Dutch. Dutch people talking at a desk, more Dutch people talking at a desk. And though there was Sky News and CNN and BBC, none of the local news was in English. Nothing that mattered, nothing pertaining to me or the parking garage. Though at one point I had a bad start when, flipping through the channels past an old American cop show, I stopped astonished at the sight of my 25-year-old father. One of his many non-speaking roles, a yes man hovering behind a political candidate at a press conference, nodding at the guy's campaign promises, and for one eerie blink glancing into the camera and straight across the ocean and into the future, at me. The multiple ironies of this were so layered and uncanny that I gaped in horror. Except for his haircut and his heavier build, bulked up from lifting weights, he'd been going to the gym a lot in those days. He might have been my twin. But the biggest shock was how straightforward he looked. My already, circa 1985, criminally dishonest and sliding into alcoholism father. None of his character or his future was visible in his face. Instead, he looked resolute, attentive, a model of certainty and promise. After that, I switched the television off. Increasingly, my main contact with reality was room service, which I only ordered up in the blackest pre-dawn hours when the delivery boys were slow and sleepy. "No, I'd like Dutch papers, please," I said in English to the Dutch-speaking bellhop who brought up the International Herald Tribune with my Dutch rolls and coffee, my ham and eggs and chef's assortment of Dutch cheeses. But since he kept turning up with the Tribune anyway, I went down the back stairs before sunrise for the local papers, which were conveniently fanned on a table just off the staircase, where I didn't have to pass the front desk. Bloedend. Moord. The sun didn't seem to rise until about 9 in the morning, and even then it was hazed and gloomy, casting a low, weak, purgatorial light like a stage effect in some German opera. Apparently the toothpaste I'd used on the lapel of my coat had contained peroxide or some other bleaching agent, since the scrubbed spot had faded to a white halo the size of my hand, chalky at the outer edges, ringing the just visible ghost of Fritz's cranial plasma. At about 3:30 in the afternoon, the light began to go. By 5 p.m., it was blackout. Then, if there weren't too many people on the street, I turned up the lapels of my coat and tied my scarf tight at the neck, taking care to keep my head down, ducked out in the dark to a tiny, Asian-run market a few hundred yards from the hotel, where with my remaining euros I bought pre-wrapped sandwiches, apples, a new toothbrush, cough drops and aspirin and beer.
"Is alles?"
said the old lady in broken-sounding Dutch, counting my coins with infuriating slowness. Click, click, click. Though I had credit cards, I was determined not to use them. Another arbitrary rule in the game I'd devised for myself. A completely irrational precaution, because who was I kidding? What did it matter? A couple of sandwiches at a convenience shop when they already had my card at the hotel. It was partly fear and partly illness that clouded my judgment, since whatever cold or chill I'd caught wasn't going away. With every hour, it seemed, my cough got deeper and my lungs hurt more. It was true about the Dutch and cleanliness, Dutch cleaning products. The market had a bewildering selection of never-before-seen items, and I returned to the room with a bottle featuring a snow-white swan against a snow-topped mountain and a skull and crossbones label on the back. But though it was strong enough to leach the stripes out of my shirt, it wasn't strong enough to lift the stains at the collar, which had faded from liver-dark blobs to sinister, overlapping outlines like bracket fungi. For the fourth or fifth time, I rinsed it, eyes streaming, then wrapped it and tied it in plastic bags and pushed it to the back of a high cupboard. Without something to weigh it down, I knew it would float if I dropped it in the canal, and I was afraid to take it to the street and shove it in a rubbish bin. Someone would see me, I'd be caught. This was how it would happen. I knew it deeply and irrationally, like knowledge in a dream. A little while. What was a little while? 3 days tops, Boris had said, at Anne de Larmison's. But then, he hadn't factored in Fritz and Martin. Bells and garlands, advent stars in the shop windows, ribbons and gilded walnuts. At night I slept with socks, stained overcoat, polo neck sweater in addition to coverlet, since the counterclockwise turn of radiator knob as advertised in the leather-bound hotel booklet didn't warm the room enough to help my fever aches and chills. White goose down, white swans. The room reeked of bleach like a cheap jacuzzi. Could the chambermaid smell it in the hall? They wouldn't give you more than 10 years for art theft, but with Martin I'd crossed the border into a different country. One way, no return. Yet somehow I'd developed a workable way of thinking about Martin's death, or thinking around it, rather. The act, the eternity of it, had thrown me into such a different world that to all practical purposes, I was already dead. There was a sense of being past everything, of looking back at land from an ice floe drifted out to sea. What was done could never be undone. I was gone. And that was fine. I didn't matter much in the scheme of things, and Martin didn't either. We were easily forgotten. It was a social and moral lesson, if nothing else. But for all foreseeable time to come, for as long as history was written, until the ice caps melted and the streets of Amsterdam were awash with water, the painting would be remembered and mourned. Who knew or cared the names of the Turks who blew the roof off the Parthenon? The mullahs who had ordered the destruction of the Buddhas at Bamiyan? Yet living or dead, their acts stood. It was the worst kind of immortality. Intentionally or no, I had extinguished a light at the heart of the world. An act of God. That was what the insurance companies called it. Catastrophe so random or arcane that there was otherwise no taking the measure of it. Probability was one thing, but some events fell so far outside the actuarial tables that even insurance underwriters were compelled to haul in the supernatural in order to explain them. Rotten luck, as my father had said mournfully one night out by the pool, dusk falling hard, smoking Viceroy after Viceroy to keep the mosquitoes away. One of the few times he tried to talk to me about my mother's death. Why do bad things happen? Why me? Why her? Wrong place, wrong time. Just a fluke, kid. One in a million. Not an evasion or cop-out in any way, but, I recognized coming from him, a profession of faith, and the best answer he had to give me. On a par with, Allah has written it, or it's the Lord's will. A sincere bowing of the head to fortune. The greatest God he knew. If he were in my shoes, it almost made me laugh. I could imagine him holed up and pacing, all too clearly, trapped and prowling, relishing the drama of the predicament, a framed cop in a jail cell as portrayed by Farley Granger. But I could imagine just as well his second-hand fascination at my plight, its turns and reversals, as random as any turn of the cards. Could imagine only too well his woeful shake of the head. Bad planets. There's a shape to this thing, a larger pattern. If we're just talking story, kid, you got it. He'd be doing his numerology or whatever, looking at his Scorpio book, flipping coins, consulting the stars. Whatever you said about my dad, you couldn't say he didn't have a cohesive worldview. The hotel was filling up for the holidays. Couples. American servicemen talking in the halls with a military flatness, rank and authority audible in their voices. In bed, in my opiated fevers, I dreamed of snowy mountains, pure and terrifying, alpine vistas from newsreel films of Berchtesgaden, great winds that crossfaded and blew with the wind-whipped seas in the oil painting above my desk, tiny tossed sailboat, alone in dark waters. My father. Put down that remote control when I'm talking to you. My father. Well, I won't say disaster, but failure. My father. Does he have to eat with us, Audrey? Does he have to sit at the table with us every fucking night? Can't you make Alameda feed him before I get home? Uno, Battleship, Etch-a-Sketch, Connect Four. Some green army figures and creepy crawly rubber insects I'd got in my Christmas stocking. Mr. Barber, two flag signal. Victor, require assistance. Echo, I am altering my course to starboard. The apartment on 7th Avenue. Rainy day gray. Many hours spent blowing in and out monotonously on a toy harmonica. In and out. In and out. On Monday, or maybe it was Tuesday, when I finally worked up the nerve to pull up the blackout shade, so late in the afternoon that the light was going, there was a television crew on the street outside my hotel, waylaying Christmas tourists. English voices. American voices. Christmas concerts at St. Nikolaskirk. And seasonal stalls selling Olieballen. Almost got hit by a bicycle, but apart from that, it's been a fun time. My chest hurt. I drew the blackouts again and stood in a hot shower with the water beating down until my skin was sore. The whole neighborhood sparkled with fairy-lit restaurants, beautiful shops displaying cashmere topcoats and heavy, hand-knit sweaters, and all the warm clothes I'd neglected to pack. But I didn't even dare phone down for a pot of coffee, thanks to the Dutch language newspapers I'd been thrashing through since well before sunrise that morning. One featuring a front-page photo of the parking garage, with police tape across the exit. The papers were spread on the floor on the far side of my bed, like a map to some horrible place I didn't want to go. Repeatedly, unable to help myself, in between drowsing off and falling into feverish conversations I wasn't having, with people I wasn't having them with, I went back and scoured them over and over for Dutch-English cognates, which were few and far between. American dood aangetroffen. Heroin, cocaine. Moord. Mortality, mordant, morbid, murder. Drugs gerelateerd criminaliteit. Fritz Altink, uit Amsterdam, and Mackay Fiedler Martin, uit Los Angeles. Bloedig, bloody. Weerschoten. Who could say, although, schoten. Could that mean shots? Deze moorden kwamen als een schokvoer. What? Boris. I walked to the window and stood, and then walked back again. Even in the confusion on the bridge, I remembered him instructing me not to call. He'd been very firm on the point. Though we'd parted in such haste, I wasn't sure he'd explained why I was supposed to wait for him to contact me. And in any case, I wasn't sure it mattered anymore. He'd also been very firm on the point that he wasn't hurt, or so I kept reminding myself, though in the swamp of unwanted memories that bombarded me from that evening, I kept seeing the burnt hole in the arm of his coat, sticky black wool and the roll of the sodium lamps. For all I knew, the traffic police had caught him on the bridge and hauled him in for driving without a license. An admittedly shitty break, if indeed the case, but a lot better than some of the other possibilities I could think of. Twee doden be bloediger. It didn't stop. There was more. The next day and the next, along with my traditional Dutch breakfast, there was more about the killings on the Overtoom. smaller column inches but denser information. Tre dödliga slaktoffers. Någon av mer betrokkenen. Fappen gewalt in Nederland. Fritz's photograph, along with the photos of some other guys with Dutch names and a longish article I had no hope of reading. Dödliga shit parte nog onopgeheldet. It worried me that they'd stopped talking about drugs, Boris's red herring, and had moved on to other angles. I'd set this thing loose. It was out in the world. People were reading about it all over the city, talking about it in a language that wasn't mine. Huge Tiffany ad in the Herald Tribune. Timeless beauty and craftsmanship. Happy holidays from Tiffany and Company. Chance plays tricks, my dad had liked to say. Systems. Spread breakdowns. Where was Boris? In my fever haze, I tried unsuccessfully to amuse or at least divert myself with thoughts of how very likely he was to show up at just the moment you didn't expect him. Cracking his knuckles, making the girls jump. Turning up half an hour after our state-issued proficiency exam had begun. Widespread classroom laughter at his puzzled face through the wire-reinforced glass of the locked door. Ha, our bright future, he'd said scornfully, when on the way home I'd tried to explain to him about standardized tests. In my dreams, I couldn't get to where I needed to be. There was always something keeping me from where I needed to go. He had texted me his number before we left the States, and though I was afraid to text him back, not knowing his circumstances or if the text could be traced back to me somehow, I reminded myself continually that I could reach him if I had to. He knew where I was. Yet, hours into the night, I lay awake arguing with myself. Relentless tedium, back and forth. What if? What if? What harm could it do? At last, at some disoriented point, nightlight burning, half dreaming, out of it, I broke down and reached for the phone on the nightstand and texted him anyway before I had the chance to think better of it. Where are you? Over the next 2 or 3 hours, I lay awake in a state of barely controlled anxiety, lying with my forearm over my face to keep the light out, even though there wasn't any light. Unfortunately, when I woke from my sweat-soaked sleep, somewhere around dawn, the phone was stone dead because I'd forgotten to switch it off and, reluctant to negotiate the front desk, to ask if they had chargers for loan. I hesitated for hours until finally, mid-afternoon, I broke down. Certainly, sir, said the desk clerk, hardly looking at me. United States? Thank God, I thought, trying not to hurry too much as I walked upstairs. The phone was old and slow, and after I plugged it in and stood for a while, I got tired of waiting for the Apple logo to come up and went to the minibar and got myself a drink and came back and stared at it a bit more until at last the lock screen came up. Old school photo I'd scanned in as a joke. Never had I been so glad to see a picture. 10-year-old Kitsy flying midair at the penalty kick. But just as I was about to type in the passcode, the home screen popped off, then fizzed for about 10 seconds, bands of black and gray that shifted and broke into particles, before the sad face came on and clicked with a queasy down-whir to black. 4:15 p.m. The sky was turning ultramarine over the Bell Gables across the canal. The deep, improbable blue of Van Gogh's Night Cafe. I was sitting on the carpet with my back against the bed and the charger cord in my hand, having methodically twice tried all the sockets in the room. I'd switched the phone on and off 100 times, held it to the lamp to see if maybe it was on and the display had just gone dark, tried to reset it, but the phone was fried. Nothing happening. Cold black screen, dead as a doornail. Clearly I'd short-circuited it. The night of the garage, it had gotten wet. Drops of water on the screen when I took it from my pocket. But though I'd had a bad minute or two waiting for it to come on, it had seemed to be working just fine, right up until the moment I tried to put a charge back in it. Everything was backed up on my laptop at home, apart from the only thing I needed, Boris's number, which he'd texted me in the car on the way to the airport. Water reflections wavering on the ceiling. Outside, somewhere, tinny Christmas carillon music and off-key carolers singing. O Tannenbaum, O Tannenbaum, the Truhe sind deine Blätter. I didn't have a return ticket, but I had a credit card. I could take a cab to the airport. You can take a cab to the airport, I told myself. Schiphol, first plane out. Kennedy, Newark. I had money. I was talking to myself like a child. Who knew where Kitsy was? Out in the Hamptons, for all I knew. But Mrs. Barber's assistant, Janet, who still had her old job despite the fact that Mrs. Barber had nothing much she needed assisting with anymore, was the kind of person who could get you on a plane out of anywhere with a few hours' notice, even on Christmas Eve. Janet. The thought of Janet was absurdly reassuring. Janet, who was an efficient mood system all her own. Janet, fat and rosy in her pink Shetlands and Madras plaids like a Boucher nymph as dressed by J. Crew. Janet, who said, excellent, in answer to everything, and drank coffee from a pink mug that said, Janet. It was a relief to be thinking straight. What good was it doing Boris or anyone, me, waiting around? The cold and damp, the unreadable language, fever and cough, the nightmare sense of constraint. I didn't want to leave without Boris, without knowing if Boris was okay. It was the war movie confusion of running on and leaving a fallen friend with no idea what worse hell you were running into. But at the same time, I wanted out of Amsterdam so badly I could imagine falling to my knees upon disembarkation at Newark, touching my forehead to the concourse floor. Telephone book, pencil and paper. Only three people had seen me, the Indonesian, Grosdan, and the Asian kid. And while it was quite possible Martin and Fritz had colleagues in Amsterdam looking for me, another good reason to get out of town, I had no reason to think the police were looking for me at all. There was no reason they would have flagged my passport. Then, it was like being struck in the face. I flinched. For whatever reason, I'd been thinking that my passport was downstairs, where I'd had to present it at check-in. But in truth, I hadn't thought of it at all. Not since Boris had taken it away from me to lock in the glove box of his car. Very, very calmly, I set down the phone book, making an effort to set it down in a manner that would look casual and unstudied to some neutral observer. In a normal situation, it was straightforward enough. Look up the address, find the office, figure out where to go, stand in line, await my turn, speak courteously and patiently. I had credit cards, photo ID. Hobie could fax my birth certificate. Impatiently, I tried to beat back an anecdote Toddy Barber had told at dinner. How, upon losing his passport, in Italy, Spain, he'd been required to haul in a flesh-and-blood witness to vouch for his identity. Bruised, inky skies. It was early in America. Hobie just breaking for lunch, walking over to Jefferson Market, maybe picking up groceries for the lunch he was hosting on Christmas Day. Was Pippa in California still? I imagined her tumbling over in a hotel bed and reaching sleepily for the telephone, eyes still closed. Theo, is that you? Is something wrong? Better fine, and talk our way out of it in case we are stopped. I felt ill. To present myself at the consulate, or whatever, for a round of interviews and paperwork, was asking for far more trouble than I needed. I hadn't put a time limit on waiting, on how long I would wait, and yet any movement, random movement, senseless movement, insect buzzing around a jar movement, seemed preferable to being cooped up in the room even 1 minute more, seeing shadow people out of the corner of my eye. Another huge Tiffany ad in the Tribune, bringing me season's greetings. Then on the opposite page, a different ad for digital cameras, scrawled in artsy letters and signed Jean Miro. You can look at a picture for a week and never think of it again. You can also look at a picture for a second and think of it all your life. Central Station, European Union, no passport control at the borders. Any train, anywhere. I pictured myself riding in aimless circles through Europe, Rhine falls and Tyrolean passes, cinematic tunnels and snowstorms. Sometimes it's about playing a poor hand well, I remembered my dad saying drowsily, half asleep on the couch. Staring at the telephone, lightheaded with fever, I sat very still and tried to think. Boris, at lunch, had spoken of taking the train from Amsterdam to Antwerp and Frankfurt. I didn't want to go anywhere near Germany, but also to Paris. If I went to a consulate in Paris to apply for a new passport, maybe less likelihood of connection with the Martin stuff. But there was no getting away from the fact that the Chinese kid was an eyewitness. For all I knew, I was on every law enforcement computer in Europe. I went to the bathroom to splash water on my face. Too many mirrors. I switched off the water and reached for a towel to pat my face dry. Methodical actions, one by one. It was after nightfall when my mood always darkened, when I began to be afraid. Glass of water. Aspirin for my fever. That too always began to climb after dark. Simple actions. I was working myself up, and I knew it. I didn't know what warrants Boris had out on him, but though it was worrying to think he'd been arrested, I was a lot more worried that Sasha's people had sent someone else after him. But this was yet another thought I could not allow myself to follow. 2. The next day, Christmas Eve, I forced myself to eat a huge room service breakfast, even though I didn't want it, and threw away the newspaper without looking at it, since I was afraid if I saw the words Overtum or Mord one more time, there was no way I could make myself do what I had to do. After I'd eaten, stolidly, I gathered the week's accumulation of newspapers on and around my bed and rolled them up and put them in the trash basket, retrieved from the cupboard my bleach-rotted shirt, and, after checking to see the bag was tied tight, slipped it into another bag from the Asian market, leaving it open for carrying ease, also in case I happened to spot a helpful brick. Then, after turning up my coat lapel and tying my scarf over it, I turned around the sign for the chambermaid and left. The weather was rotten, which helped. Wet sleet blowing in sideways drizzled over the canal. I walked for about 20 minutes, sneezing, miserable, chilled, until I happened upon a rubbish bin on a particularly deserted corner, with no cars or foot traffic, no shops, only blind-looking houses shuttered tight against the wind. Quickly, I shoved the shirt in and walked on, with a burst of exhilaration that sped me 4 or 5 streets along very rapidly, despite chattering teeth. My feet were wet. The soles of my shoes were too thin for the cobblestones, and I was very cold. When did they pick up the garbage? No matter. Unless, I shook my head to clear it. The Asian market. The plastic bag had the name of the Asian market on it, only a few blocks from my hotel. But it was ridiculous to think this way, and I tried to reason myself out of it. Who had seen me? No one. Charlie, affirmative. Delta, I am proceeding with difficulty. Stop it. Stop it. No going back. Not knowing where a taxi stand was, I trudged along aimlessly for 20 minutes or more until finally I managed to flag down a taxi on the street. Central Station, I told the Turkish cab driver. But when the driver left me off in front, after a drive through haunted gray streets like old newsreel footage, I thought for a moment he'd taken me to the wrong place, since the building from the front looked more like a museum. Red brick fantasia of gables and towers, bristling Dutch Victoriana. In I wandered, amidst holiday crowds, doing my best to look as if I belonged, and ignoring the police who seemed to be standing around nearly everywhere I looked, and feeling bewildered and uneasy as the great democratic world swept and surged around me once more. Grandparents, students, weary young marrieds, and little kids dragging backpacks, shopping bags and Starbucks cups, rattle of suitcase wheels, teenagers collecting signatures for Greenpeace, back in the hum of human things. There was an afternoon train to Paris, but I wanted the latest one they had. The lines were endless, all the way back to the news kiosk.
This evening?
Said the clerk when I finally got to the window. A broad, fair, middle-aged woman, pillowy at the bosom and impersonally genial like a procuress in a second-rate genre painting. That's right, I said, hoping I didn't quite look as sick as I felt.
How many?
She said, hardly looking at me. Just one.
Certainly. Passport, please. Just a...
Voice husky with illness, patting myself down. I'd hoped they wouldn't ask. Sorry, I don't have it on me. It's in the safe back at the hotel. But... Producing my New York State ID, my credit cards, my social security card, pushing them through the window.
Here you go.
You require a passport to travel.
Oh, sure.
Doing my best to sound reasonable, knowledgeable.
But I'm not leaving till tonight. See,
indicating the empty floor space at my feet.
No luggage. I'm seeing my girlfriend off. And since I'm here, I thought I'd go ahead and get in line and buy the ticket, if that's all right.
Well,
the clerk glanced at her screen.
You have plenty of time. I'd suggest you wait and purchase your ticket when you return this evening.
Yes,
pinching my nose so I wouldn't sneeze.
But I'd like to purchase it now.
I'm afraid that's not possible.
Please. It'd be a huge help. I've been standing here for 45 minutes and I don't know what the lines will be like tonight.
From Pippa, who had gone all over Europe by rail, I was fairly sure I remembered hearing they didn't check passports for the train.
All I want is to buy it now, so I have time to run all my errands before I come back this evening.
The clerk looked hard at my face. Then she picked up the ID and looked at the picture, then again at me.
Look,
I said when she hesitated or seemed to hesitate.
You can see it's me. You have my name, my social security card. Here,
I said, reaching in my pocket for pen and paper.
Let me duplicate the signature for you.
Side by side, she compared the two. Again, she looked at me and the card, and then, all at once, seemed to make up her mind.
I can't accept this documentation.
Pushing my cards back to me through the window.
Why not?
The line behind me was growing.
Why?
I repeated.
It's perfectly legitimate. It's what I use in lieu of a passport to fly in the U.S. The signatures match,
I said when she didn't answer.
Can't you see?
Sorry.
You mean...
I could hear the desperation in my voice. She was meeting my gaze aggressively as if defying me to argue.
You're telling me I've got to come all the way back here tonight and stand in line all over again?
Sorry, sir. Can't help you. Next,
said the clerk, looking over my shoulder at the next passenger. As I was walking away, pushing and bumping my way through crowds, someone said behind me,
Hey. Hey, mate.
At first, disoriented from the ticket window, I thought I was hallucinating the voice. But when uneasily I turned, I saw a ferret-faced teenager with pink-rimmed eyes and a shaved head bouncing up and down on the toes of his gigantic sneakers. From his darting side-to-side glance, I thought at first he was going to offer to sell me a passport, but instead he leaned forward and said,
Don't try it.
What? I said uncertainly, glancing up at the policewoman standing about 5 feet behind him.
Listen, mate. Back and forth 100 times when I had the thing, and I never checked once. But the one time I didn't have it, crossing into France, they locked me up, didn't they? France, immigration jail. 12 hours with their rubbish food and rubbish attitude. Horrible. Horrible, dirty police cell. Trust me. You want your documents in order. And no funny shit in your case, either.
Hey, right,
I said, sweating in my coat, which I didn't dare unbutton. Scarf I didn't dare untie.
Hot. Headache.
Walking away from him, I felt the furious gaze of a security camera burning into me, and I tried not to look self-conscious as I threaded through the crowds, floating and woozy with fever, grinding the phone number of the American consulate in my pocket. It took me a while to find a payphone, all the way at the other end of the station, in an area packed with sketchy teenagers sitting in quasi-tribal council on the floor, and it took even longer for me to figure out how to make the actual call. Buoyant stream of Dutch. Then I was greeted by a pleasant American voice. Welcome to the United States Consulate of the Netherlands. Would I like to continue in English? More menus, more options. Press 1 for this, press 2 for that, please hold for operator. Patiently, I followed the instructions, and stood gazing out at the crowd until I realized maybe it wasn't such a great idea to let people see my face and turned back to the wall. The telephone rang so long I drifted off into a dissociated fog when suddenly the line clicked on. Easy American voice sounding fresh off the beach at Santa Cruz.
Good morning, American Consulate of the Netherlands. How may I help you?
Hi, I said, relieved. I debated giving a false name just to get the information I wanted, but I was too faint and exhausted to bother. I'm afraid I'm in a jam. My name is Theodore Decker, and my passport's been stolen.
Hey, sorry to hear that.
She was keying in something. I could hear her on the other end. Christmas music playing in the background.
Bad time of year for it. Everyone traveling, you know. Did you report to the authorities?
What?
Stolen passport? Because you have to report it immediately. The police need to know right away.
Cursing myself, why had I said it was stolen? No, sorry, it just happened. Central Station. I looked around. I'm calling from a payphone. To tell you the truth, I'm not sure it was stolen. I think it fell out of my pocket.
Well, more keyboarding. Lost or stolen, you still have to make a police report.
Yeah, but I was just about to catch a train, see, and now they won't let me on. And I have to be in Paris tonight.
Hang on a sec.
There were too many people in the train station. Damp wool and muggy crowd smells blooming horribly in the overheated warmth. In a moment, she clicked back on.
Now, let me get some information from you.
Name, date of birth, date and city of passport issue. Sweating in my overcoat. Humid, breathing bodies all around.
Do you have documentation establishing your citizenship?
She was saying.
Sorry? An expired passport, birth or naturalization certificate?
I have a social security card and a New York State ID. I can have a copy of my birth certificate faxed from the States.
Oh, great. That should be sufficient.
Really? I stood motionless. Was that all?
Do you have access to a computer?
Computer at the hotel? Sure.
Well, she gave me a web address. You'll need to download, print, and fill out an affidavit regarding lost and stolen passport and bring it here, to our offices. We're near the Rijksmuseum. Do you know where?
I was so relieved that I could only stand there and let the crowd noises babble and stream over me in a psychedelic blur.
So, this is what I need from you,
California girl was saying, her crisp voice recalling me from my varicolored fever reverie.
The affidavit, the fax documents, two copies of a 5x5 centimeter photograph with a white background. Also, don't forget, copy of the police report.
Sorry, I said, jarred.
Like I was saying, with lost or stolen passports, we require you to file a police report.
Staring at an eerie convergence of veiled Arabic women, gliding past silently and head to toe black. I won't have time for that.
What do you mean?
It's not like I'm flying to America today. It's just that... It took me a moment to recover. My coughing fit had brought tears to my eyes. My train to Paris leaves in 2 hours. So, I mean, I don't know what to do. I'm not sure I can get all this paperwork done and make it to the police station, too.
Well,
regretfully.
Hey, actually, you know, our offices are only open for another 45 minutes.
What?
We close early today. Christmas Eve, you know? And we're gone tomorrow and the weekend. But we'll be open again at 8:30 a.m. on the Monday after Christmas.
Monday?
Hey, I'm sorry,
she said. She sounded resigned.
It's a process.
But it's an emergency. Voice rasping with illness.
Emergency? Family or medical? Because in certain very rare situations, we do supply emergency after-hours support.
She wasn't so friendly anymore. She was rushed, reciting from her script. I could hear another call ringing in the background like a radio phone-in show.
Unfortunately, this is confined to urgent situations of life or death. And our staff has to determine that domestic emergency is warranted before we issue a passport waiver. So, unless circumstances of death or critical illness require you to travel to Paris this afternoon, And unless you can supply information establishing the critical emergency, such as an affidavit with attending physician, clergy, or funeral director,
Monday? Fuck. I didn't even want to think about the police report. Hey, sorry. Listen.
She was trying to ring off.
That's right. You get it all together by Monday the 28th. And then, yes, once the application is in, we'll process it for you as quickly as we can. Sorry, will you excuse me a second?
Click. Her voice, fainter.
Good morning, United States Consulate of the Netherlands. Will you please hold?
Immediately, the phone began to ring again. Click.
Good morning, United States Consulate of the Netherlands. Will you please hold?
How fast can you have it for me?
I said, when she came back on.
Oh, once you get the application in, we should actually have it for you within 10 working days, tops. That's working days. Like, normally I'd do my best to rush it through for you in 7, but with the holidays, I'm sure you understand, the office is a little backed up right now, and our hours are really irregular until New Year's. So, hey, sorry,
she added in the stunned silence that had fallen.
It may be a while. Rotten news, I know.
What am I supposed to do?
Do you need traveler's assistance?
I'm not sure what that means.
Sweat pouring off me. Rank, heated air, heavy with crowd odors, barely breathable.
Money wired? Temporary accommodations?
How am I supposed to get home?
You're a resident of Paris?
No, United States.
Well, with a temporary passport. A temporary passport doesn't even have the chip you need to enter the United States, so I'm not sure that there are really any shortcuts that will get you there a whole lot faster than I can get you there by...
Ring, 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 ring.
Just a moment, sir. Will you please hold? Now, my name is Holly. Would you like me to give you my extension number, just in case you run into any problems or need any assistance during your stay?
3. My fever, for whatever reason, tended to spike at nightfall. But after so long on my feet in the cold, it had begun to shoot up in ragged jumps that had the jerky quality of a heavy object being hauled by fits and starts up the side of a tall building, so that on the walk home I hardly understood why I was moving, or why I didn't fall down, or indeed how I was proceeding forward at all, a sort of groundless gliding unconsciousness that carried me high above myself on rainy canal side streets and up into disembodied lofts and drafts where I seemed to be looking down on myself from above. It had been a mistake not to get a cab back at the station. I kept seeing the plastic bag in the garbage bin and the shiny pink face of the ticket clerk, and Boris, with tears in his eyes and blood on his hand, clutching at the burnt place on his sleeve. And the wind roared and my head burned, and at irregular intervals I flinched at dark, epileptic flutters at elbow's edge. Black splashes, false starts, no one there. In fact, no one on the street at all except, every now and then, a cyclist dim and hunched in the drizzle. Heavy head, bad throat. When, finally, I managed to flag down a cab on the street, I was only a few minutes from the hotel. The one good thing, when I got upstairs, bone-chilled and shaking, was that they'd cleaned the room and restocked the bar, which I'd drunk clear down to the Cointreau. I retrieved both mini bottles of gin and mixed them with hot water from the tap, and sat in the brocade chair by the window, glass dangling from my fingertips, watching the hours slide, barely awake, a half-dreaming state, solemn winter light tilting from wall to wall in parallelograms that slipped to the carpet and narrowed out until they faded out to nothing, and it was dinner time, and my stomach ached and my throat was raw with bile, and there I still sat, in the dark. It was nothing I hadn't thought of, plenty, and in far less taxing circumstances. The urge shook me grandly and unpredictably, a poisonous whisper that never wholly left me, that on some days lingered just on the threshold of my hearing, but on others roared up uncontrollably into a sort of lurid visionary frenzy. Why, I wasn't sure. Sometimes even a bad movie or a gruesome dinner party could trigger it. Short-term boredom and long-term pain, temporary panic and permanent desperation, striking all at once and flaring up in such an ashen, desolate light that I saw, really saw, looking back down the years, and with all clear-headed and articulate despair, that the world and everything in it was intolerably and permanently fucked, and nothing had ever been good or okay. Unbearable claustrophobia of the soul, the windowless room, no way out, waves of shame and horror, leave me alone. My mother, dead on a marble floor. Stop it, stop it. Muttering aloud to myself in elevators, in cabs. Leave me alone, I want to die. A cold, intelligent, self-immolating fury that had, more than once, driven me upstairs in a resolute fog to swallow indiscriminate combos of whatever booze and pills I happened to have on hand. Only tolerance and ineptitude that I'd botched it. Unpleasantly surprised when I woke up, though relieved for Hobie that he hadn't had to find me. Black birds. Disastrous, lead-colored skies out of Egbert van der Poel. I stood and snapped on the desk light, swaying in the weak, urine-colored glow. There was waiting. There was running away. But these were not so much choices as endurance measures. The useless scurries and freezes of a mouse in a snake tank, serving only to prolong discomfort and suspense. And there was also a third choice, since for various reasons I felt that a consulate member would be fairly speedy to return my call if I left an after-hours message stating that I was an American citizen wishing to turn myself in for capital murder. Act of rebellion. Life. Vacant, vain, intolerable. What loyalty did I owe it? None whatsoever. Why not beat fate to the punch, throw the book on the fire, and be done with it? There was no end in sight to the present horror. Plenty of external, empirical horror to line up with my own endogenous supply. And, given enough dope, inspecting the bag, less than half left, I would happily have set up a fat line and toppled right over. Great soul darkness. Explosion of stars. But there wasn't enough to be sure of finishing myself off. I didn't want to waste what I had on a few hours of oblivion, only to wake up again in my cage, or worse, in a Dutch hospital with no passport. Then again my tolerance was down, and I was pretty sure I had enough to do the job if I got good and drunk first, and topped it off with my emergency pill. Bottle of chilled white in the minibar. Why not? I drank the rest of my gin and uncorked it, feeling resolute and jubilant. I was hungry. They'd restocked the crackers and cocktail snacks, but this was all going to work a lot better on an empty stomach. The relief was immense. Quiet dismissal. Perfect, perfect joy of throwing it all away. I found a classical station on the radio. Christmas plain chant, somber and liturgical. Less melody than a spectral commentary on it, and thought about running myself a bath. But that could wait. Instead, I opened the desk and found a folder of hotel stationery. Gray cathedral stone, minor hexachords. Rex virginum amator. Between fever and canal water lapping outside, the space around me had fallen quietly into haunted doubleness, a border zone which was both hotel room and the cabin of a gently tossing ship. Life on the high seas. Death by water. Andy, when we were kids, telling me in his eerie Martian boy voice that he'd heard on the Learning Channel that Mary protected sailors, that one of the protections of the rosary was that you could never die by drowning. Mary Stella Maris. Mary, Star of the Sea. I thought of Hobie at midnight mass, kneeling in the pew in his black suit. Gilding wears away naturally. On a cabinet door, on the flap of a bureau, there are often a quantity of tiny indentations. Objects seeking out their rightful owners. They had human qualities. They were shifty or honest or suspicious or fine. Really remarkable pieces do not appear on the scene from nowhere. The hotel pen wasn't great. I wished I had a better one. But the paper was creamy and thick. Four letters. Hobie's and Mrs. Barber's would have to be the longest, as they were the persons who most deserved an explanation, and also because they were the only persons who, if I died, would actually care. But I would write to Kitsy as well, to assure her that it wasn't her fault, Pippa's letter would be the shortest. I wanted her to know just how much I loved her, while also letting her know that she bore not one particle of blame for not loving me back. But I wouldn't say that. It was rose petals I wanted to throw, not a poison dart. The point was to let her know, briefly, how happy she had made me, while leaving out all the more obvious part. When I shut my eyes, I was struck by clinically sharp flashes of memory that the fever brought bursting up from nowhere, like tracer rounds going off in the jungle, lurid flares of highly detailed and emotionally complex material, harp strings of light through the barred windows of our old apartment on 7th Avenue, scratchy sisal matting, and the red waffled texture it left in my hands and knees when I was playing down on the floor. A tangerine party dress of my mother's with shiny things on the skirt I always wanted to touch. Alameda, our old housekeeper, mashing plantains in a glass bowl. Andy, saluting me before dashing down the gloomy hall of his parents' apartment. Aye, Captain. Medieval voices, austere and otherworldly. The gravity of unadorned song. I didn't actually feel upset. That was the thing. Instead, it was more like the last and worst of my root canals when the dentist had leaned in under the lamps and said, almost done. December 24th. Dear Kitsy, I'm terribly sorry about this, but I want you to know that it has nothing to do with you and nothing to do with any of your family. Your mother will be receiving a separate letter which will have a bit more information, but in the meantime, I want to assure you, privately, that my course of action has not been influenced by anything that has happened between us, especially events of late. Where this stiff voice and unnaturally stiff handwriting had come from, incongruous with the cloudbursts of memory and hallucination crashing in on me from all sides, I did not know. The wet sleet pelting against the window panes had a kind of deep historical weight to it. Starvation, armies marching, a never-ending drizzle of sadness. As you well know, and have pointed out to me yourself, I have numerous problems that began long before I met you, and none of these problems are your fault. If your mother has questions for you about your role in recent events, I should urge you to refer her to Tessa Margolis, or, even better, M, who will be more than delighted to share her views on my character. Also, completely unrelated matter, but I also urge you not to let Havistock Irving into your apartment again. Ever. Kitsy as a child. Fine hair straggling in her face. Shut up, you goofballs. Cut it out or I'll tell. Last but not least, my pen hovering over this line. Last but not least, I want to tell you how beautiful you looked at the party, and how touched I was that you wore my mother's earrings. She was crazy about Andy. She would have loved you too, and would have loved for us to be together. I'm sorry it didn't work out, but I do hope things work out for you. Really. Best love, Theo. Sealed, addressed, put aside. They'd have stamps at the front desk. Dear Hobie, this is a hard letter to write, and I'm sorry to be writing it. Alternate sweats and frosts. I was seeing green spots. My fever was so high the walls seemed to be shrinking. This isn't about the bad pieces I've sold. I expect you'll hear soon enough what it's about. Nitric acid, lamp black. Furniture, like all living things, acquired marks and scars over the course of time. The effects of time, visible and invisible. And I don't quite know how to say this, but I guess what I'm thinking about is this sick puppy my mother and I found on the street in Chinatown. She was lying in a space between two garbage cans. She was a baby pit bull. Smelly, dirty. Skin and bones. Too weak to stand up. People just walking by her. And I got upset and my mother promised me that we'd pick her up if she was still there when we finished eating. And when we got out of the restaurant, there she still was. So we hailed a cab. I carried her in my arms. And when we got her home, my mother made her a box in the kitchen, and she was so happy and licked our faces and drank a ton of water and ate the dog food we bought her and threw it all right back up. Well, to make a long story short, she died, It wasn't our fault. We felt like it was. We took her into the vet and bought her special food, but she only got sicker and sicker. We were both really fond of her by this time. And my mother took her in again to a specialist at the Animal Medical Center. And the vet said, "This dog has a disease," which I forget the name of, "and she had it when you found her. And I know this is not what you want to hear, but it is going to be a whole lot kinder if you euthanize her right now." My hand had been flying in reckless jerks and starts across the paper. But at the end of the page, while reaching for another, I stopped, appalled. What I'd experienced as weightlessness, a sort of sweeping last-chance glide, was not at all the eloquent and affecting farewell I'd imagined. The handwriting sloped and slopped all over the place and was not intelligent or coherent or even legible. There had to be some much briefer and simpler way to thank Hobie and say what I had to say, namely that he shouldn't feel bad. He'd always been good to me and done his best to help me, just as my mother and I had done our best to help this baby pit bull, who, it was actually a pertinent point, only I didn't want to spin the story out too long, for all her sweet-tempered qualities had been incredibly destructive in the days leading to her death. She'd pretty much destroyed the whole apartment and ripped our sofa to pieces. Maudlin, self-indulgent, tasteless. My throat felt as if the lining had been scraped out with a razor. Off comes the upholstery. "Look here, we have woodworm. We'll have to treat it with cuprinol." The night I'd overdosed in Hobie's upstairs bathroom, expecting not to wake up and waking up anyway with my cheek on the trippy old hexagonal floor tile, I'd been amazed at exactly how radiant a pre-war bathroom with plain white fittings could be when you were looking at it from the afterlife. The beginning of the end? Or the end of the end? Fabelhaft. Having the best fun ever. One thing at a time. Aspirins. Cold water from the minibar. The aspirins rasped and stuck in my chest, like swallowing gravel, and I pounded trying to get them down. The booze had made me feel a whole lot sicker, thirsty, confused. Fish hooks in my throat. Water trickling absurdly down my cheeks, gasping and wheezing. I'd opened the wine as a treat, supposedly, but it was going down like turpentine, burning and razoring around in my stomach. Should I run a bath? Should I call down for something hot? Something simple? Broth or tea? No. The thing was simply to finish the wine or maybe just go right ahead and start in on the vodka. Somewhere online I'd read that only 2% of attempted suicides by overdose were successful, which seemed like an absurdly low number, although one unfortunately borne out by previous experience. "It ain't gonna rain no mo'." That was somebody's suicide note. It was only a farce. Jean Harlow's husband, who killed himself on their wedding night. George Sanders had been the best. An old Hollywood classic. My father had known it by heart and liked a quote from it. "Dear world, I am leaving because I am bored." And then Hart Crane. Pivot and drop, shirt ballooning as he fell. "Goodbye, everybody." A shouted farewell, jumping off ship. I no longer considered my body my own. It had ceased to belong to me. My hands, moving, felt separate, floating of their own accord. And when I stood, it was like operating a marionette, unfolding myself, rising jerkily on strings. Hobie had told me that when he was a young man, he drank Cutty Sark because it was Hart Crane's whiskey. Cutty Sark means short skirt. Pale green walls in the piano room, palm trees and pistachio ices. Ice-coated windows, unheated rooms of Hobie's childhood. The old masters, they were never wrong. What did I think? What did I feel? It hurt to breathe. The packet of heroin was in the night table on the other side of the bed. But though my dad, with his unflagging love for showbiz hell, would have adored the whole setup, dope, dirty ashtray, booze and all, I couldn't quite bear the thought of being found sprawled out in my complimentary hotel robe like a has-been lounge singer. The thing to do was clean up, shower and shave, and put on my suit so I didn't look too seedy when they found me, and only then, at the last, after the night chambermaids were off duty, take the do not disturb